Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
This time they mean it. In Iraq, Shiite negotiators working on a draft constitution are floating what they call a final offer to Sunni Iraqis who've objected loudly to the process. So far, three deadlines to reach an agreement on a constitution this month have come and gone. Meanwhile, a new Associated Press Ipsos poll shows that 53% of Americans surveyed think the U.S. made a mistake in going to war in Iraq. And while people think anti-war protester Cindy Sheehan has the right to speak her mind in asking for a pullout of troops, 60% of Americans polled want U.S. troops to stick it out until the country is stable. Well, joining us on the line from Baghdad is Borzu Daragahi, correspondent for the L.A. Times. And Borzu, first of all, might this final offer lead to an agreement today?
You know, it's not certain yet whether the Sunnis will accept it. Essentially, what's happened is that the Shiites have offered to water down the language on federalism. Now, federalism, as listeners may know, is the concept that Iraq would be divided into separate regions. And in the draft constitution that's in place now, there's a sort of a mechanism whereby Iraq's provinces can get together, have a referendum, and sort of create these different regions. The Sunnis don't want the word federalism even in the Constitution. They think that federalism is an Iranian and Israeli and American plot to dismember Iraq.
And besides, the Sunnis stand to lose under federalism because they have less oil in their region, etc.
Well, exactly. They fear that this will lead to a dismemberment of Iraq, where the Shiites will get the oil wells near Basra, the Kurds will get the oil wells near Kirkuk, and the Sunnis will get nothing but the desert in the middle of the country.
Well, you say that the Shiites may not be able to get the Sunnis and the Kurds to buckle on this one issue. But there's talk that this draft constitution might not even be put to a vote in the Iraqi parliament. How is that possible?
If you look at the language of the transitional administrative law, which is the sort of placeholder constitution that Paul Bremer put in March of 2003, there's a little bit of wiggle room there. It's not really clear exactly what is required of the framers of the constitution as far as the National Assembly goes. It just says they got to put it in. They got to put it in by a certain deadline. They think they can go straight to a vote on October 15th.
Yeah. Borzu, we've been hearing about deadly clashes between rival Shiite militias. There's, of course, the ongoing insurgency against the occupation or anyone who's seen as cooperating with the new Iraq. Some people are using the phrase civil war. Would you?
I would not use the phrase civil war. And I think why and this is just my sort of analysis. I think at this point you have calmer heads prevailing. You know, you've got, you know, even Muqtada's people. Muqtada Sadr is the rebel cleric, is a rabble-rousing rebel cleric who last year led an insurrection against U.S. forces. Even he's calling on his people to calm down. You've got Ayatollah Sistani. He's the highest level cleric in Iraq. He's calling on people to calm down and not take revenge against people when they're killed by Sunni insurgents. I think that it'll be a civil war when you've got the leadership telling their people to fight. And at this point, you don't have that yet.
And before I let you go, Borzu, what's your take on the comments made by the Iraqi foreign minister in Italy yesterday about anti-war protester Cindy Sheehan? He said he sympathized with her and others who've lost loved ones in this war, but that it would be disastrous if their protests led to cracks in the coalition or to a premature withdrawal of American troops. Do you find it interesting that he is even following this story, which is obviously big here?
I think everyone here in Iraq, and I've been asking around a lot about it, is following the rising anti-war sentiment in the U.S. It's not like a subject of daily concern and so on, but you got to consider that one of the main things that happened in Iraq since the fall of the regime is the sudden and dramatic appearance of 24-hour Arabic language news, the Al Jazeera effect. And this has really changed people. People are much more well-informed about what's going on in other parts of the world. Cindy Sheehan is a celebrity in Iraq, as she is in the U.S., and so they're following it closely. I think they're a little too sort of bedraggled by their very, very difficult lives, no electricity, no water, no services, to be that passionate about it one way or the other, but they're definitely following it with interest, and some are worried that if the U.S. leaves right now, the consequence will be massive civil war. Others are kind of anxious that the U.S. leaves and seeing this as a good sign that the U.S. public is sort of balking at the ongoing U.S. presence here.
Borzu Dargahi, correspondent for the Los Angeles Times in Baghdad. Borzu, thanks as always.
It's always a pleasure, Robin.
Well, now a Friday look at something millions of college students are going to be doing this weekend. It's one of the hottest things on campus. And this year, students are using it even before they reach their dorm rooms. It's called Facebook, and it's a new online networking tool created by a Harvard undergrad. Now, there are other networking sites, but this is the only one geared just to college students. Students log on to Facebook, and they can fill out a detailed profile, make campus-wide announcements, join groups, all without leaving their rooms. But while some welcome Facebook's potential to break down social barriers, others warn that it encourages students to self-segregate rather than branch out. Well, we welcome three guests today. Facebook creator Mark Zuckerberg. Mark, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Sociologist and dean of Colgate University, Adam Weinberg. Adam, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Also, the director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School, John Palfrey. John, thanks for joining us as well.
Hi, Robin. Thanks for having me.
And, Mark, I want to start with you. There are a lot of these, you know, online meet-and-greet sites for students. When did you come up with the idea for yours, and why do you think it's different?
So I came up with the idea when I was at Harvard my sophomore year. I noticed that Harvard didn't have any kind of Facebook. Some high schools and colleges have these paper Facebooks, which are just directories of people's pictures and names where you can look people up and see their picture or try to find someone who you met and see who they are. And I just kind of thought that was interesting and that there should be some place where people can look up someone else and find out information that that person wants to make publicly accessible. So, for example, what courses they're taking, who their friends are if they want, any information about them, a picture.
Mm-hmm.
So I figured that this was a pretty good website that could be made, and I threw it together.
Actually, on the site right now, our fabulous intern, Noah, is a member, and I'm on his page, a terrific picture of Noah. And then as I scroll down, I see his favorite songs. I see, personal information about him, favorite movies. And then groups, different groups of people with different interests, everything from the lovers of The Daily Show and Jon Stewart to, let's see, what shall I click on here? Well, how about I went to private school Skank, and you click on, and there are people who went to private school and want to talk about it. So is that what it's about, getting in deeper and deeper and meeting people of same interests?
I don't actually think that it's that much about meeting other people. I think that the fact that Facebook is tied so closely into the real world makes it so that it's more of a mirror of what actually exists. So, I mean, for example, that person isn't meeting people who went to private school by putting that there. They're just saying, I went to private school. You know, I identify with people who went to private school because I went to private school.
And by the way, they're putting down private school quite a bit. Well, Adam Weinberg at Colgate and John Palfrey at Harvard, I want you to jump in here as well. Adam, what are your thoughts on Facebook?
I think that technology is wonderful, but what I worry about is the way some of the students are using it. I think one of the purposes of college is to learn to walk across difference, to kind of come to meet and learn to kind of work and be friends with people who are different from yourself. I think one of the challenges for this generation is many of them grew up in metropolitan regions that were very diverse, and yet they had very homogeneous sets of life experiences. So when they arrive on a college campus where there's lots of diversity, we really want them developing multiple different types of friendship circles. And what I worry about is that too often these sorts of technologies are used to create very closed, very tight friendship networks that students then don't break out of.
Well, Mark, what do you think about that? Because we are reading that even before kids go to school now, they're using Facebook to almost set up who their friends are going to be once they get there.
So that's true. I guess people may, for the first time, be seeing people online now who are freshmen, who are going to be freshmen. But I mean, they're going to be at college for 4 years, you know, and they're going to develop much tighter bonds with people who they actually interact with in the real world than anyone who they see on Facebook. So the way that we kind of think about Facebook and the communication that exists there is that it's almost more of an icebreaker or really lightweight form of social interaction. The people who I live with or work with or take courses with and do problem sets with, I mean, I have a much deeper bond with them than anything that can ever be aided by something like Facebook. But there's a lot of people in college. I mean, college is this place where you're just meeting tons of people all the time and different things that you do. And I'll be crossing the path at school and just say hi to someone. And, I mean, what kind of a relationship do I really have with that person? How deep is that? Stuff like that can be made a little more comfortable by something like Facebook.
Yeah, John Palfrey, director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School. Harvard, birthplace of Facebook.
Accomplishment.
What are your thoughts about it?
Generally, I think the Facebook is fantastic. I'm a huge, huge fan, and I think that what Mark and his colleagues have cooked up is really a breakthrough, honestly, in terms of social networking online. And I think one of the reasons that's true is what Mark was just emphasizing a moment ago, which is it's not a social network that exists in cyberspace alone, but rather maps to a real space experience. And I guess I'm not all that concerned about people closing off their network through the use of such a social network online, but rather interested in the ways that it changes and expands. And I think that the things that are hybrids, in essence, where it actually does have a real-world component and an online component, can create kind of a neat new set of social dynamics.
Yeah, but John, what about, it has earned the nickname stalker.com. Does that bother you?
It does, in the sense that there is too much of a good thing, for sure. And I think that one factor with any online activity is you have to realize that if you put information about yourself in an online space, it is a public space and anybody from anywhere can access it. The Facebook obviously takes some reasonable controls in terms of ensuring that you can make private your information. You're not required to put anything out there.
In fact, I'm on NOAA's site. I've clicked through to edit your privacy, and you can say who you want to be able to search your file, who you want in Facebook to be able to see you in the searches. You can either click everyone else at my school, just my friends, whatever. You can limit it. But Adam, I know you have some thoughts about the kind of information that's getting into Facebook.
Yeah, I'm amazed at how much students are willing to put up on Facebook. They're willing to put up things that I didn't tell my wife till after we were married. But, I think just kind of going back to Mark's original point, I think there's a tendency to kind of vilify the technology. I think technology is great. I think that the real trick for colleges and universities is to work with students on how to use the technology in kind of appropriate and inappropriate ways. And part of it is about what you do put up online. Part of it is what you don't put up online. I think that the neat thing about Facebook is it has the real potential to make college campus culture much more egalitarian and democratic.
Well, let's give an example. On Facebook, you can find everyone who put a David Sedaris book on their profile, invite them all to join a David Sedaris fan club group, and then send them all a message about, say, an upcoming in-store appearance that he's making, and perhaps organize a field trip and go together. Another group we're seeing here is Virgins Unite. Their members currently practice or support celibacy, so there's some serious there. And we want to add that although group creators have the option to restrict access to their groups, the vast majority choose to make them open to all. And while Facebook is not the only on-campus internet site, it's certainly the most popular one. Well, when we come back from the break, we're going to hear more from Mark Zuckerberg, one of the creators of Facebook, Adam Weinberg, sociologist and dean of Colgate University, and John Palfrey, director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School. We are talking about Facebook, a social networking website used by millions of students of colleges and universities using it before they even get to college. Stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now. Topic for a Friday, Facebook.com, an online website used by millions of American college students on and between their campuses, by the way. We've been speaking with John Palfrey, director of the Berkman Institute for Society and Internet at Harvard Law School, Adam Weinberg, sociologist and dean of Colgate University, and Mark Zuckerberg, who's a Harvard undergrad and one of the creators of Facebook. And Mark, I want to ask you, I can't even keep up with my emails. So if I'm now part of this huge online community, wouldn't I feel obligated to participate? It's hard enough to keep up with friends on a day-to-day basis, much less 100 more that I'm making online.
But you're not making these friends online. They're people who are
already
your friends
right.
in real life.
Yeah.
And the upkeep of these relationships on Facebook is very little.
Well, actually, Mark, I have to tell you that I'm seeing a group. I spend all my time on the Facebook group. So,
Mark, can I ask you a question about that? I think it's an interesting observation, but I actually think it's more mixed. What I worry about is, you know, part of the great college experience for first-year students is learning to deal with discomfort. And what I worry about as a first-year student living in a residential hall is lonely those first couple nights, and what we really want them to be doing is walking down the hall, meeting their friends, going to the student union. And I do worry that for some students, rather than doing that because it's uncomfortable, they just get online and spend time on Facebooks and other forms of technology.
That's Adam Weinberg, by the way, asking that question of Mark, who created Facebook. And Adam, you're also saying that you've seen two kids sitting in the same dorm room emailing each other in the room.
Yeah, and that's certainly not a problem. Facebook, I think it's the larger point that technology is good, but how do students use it? We find that, you know, like all campuses, first-year students have roommate conflicts, and that's great. Those are wonderful moments to learn to live and work with somebody who's different from yourself, which is an important life and civic skill. But rather than engaging each other in verbal conversation, we find too many students get on their computers and start IMing each other, which is a really horrible way to kind of resolve differences.
Mark, you know? Go, your response.
Well, I think there's different weight to these interactions. I think that a face-to-face personal interaction is, I don't think anyone would argue, the richest kind of interaction. And in that sense, it's also probably the most intense. You know, I think that the real thing here is that Facebook is comfortable, you know, and I mean, people otherwise, they might just not talk to the person because it's too intense or too stressful to talk to them, but now they have a medium which is lightweight enough and not so intense that they can communicate through it.
And John Palfrey from Harvard, you're the one who said that you think that this is a, you know, a great thing in ways. It is called Facebook, and there are these beautiful pictures, all very attractive.
Uh-huh.
What does that say, that there's something superficial about a Facebook?
Well, I suppose there is something superficial about a Facebook, but I guess this is in the don't blame the technology mm-hmm. zone. I think you're right to emphasize the possibility of people being ostracized, but I would focus on how this particular social community is so closely tied into real space. So I don't think that you're spending most of your time knowing what somebody looks like just on the Facebook. You actually are seeing them in the dining hall or in a lecture hall or on the playing fields. You know perfectly well what they look like.
Mark, I mean, I think everyone would agree, just having a place to vent and for satire is just terrific in college. Are there really serious discussion groups that you can tell us about?
No, I mean, the point of groups isn't to have discussions. It's really mostly for personal expression.
I was giving you an opportunity, Mark, to say that there'd be this really serious, scholarly, deep aspect. But no, right? There's
you're
not.
You're forcing it, Rabbit.
I'm looking for it, but there's not, right, Mark?
We have classrooms for that.
Why would people have, like, intense intellectual discussions online when they could just do it in person? You know, I mean, that's, like, the type of intense interaction that this is not well suited for.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I think that this is really well suited for, we have this thing on the site which is called poking, which does nothing other than sends a message to someone the next time they log in, which is like, you have been poked by Mark. That's about as lightweight of an interaction as you can get. I don't mm-hmm. think that you can do anything in person which says like, hi, in that light of a way mm-hmm. as poking someone does.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there is some utility in having that in your kind of communication quiver.
Mark, by the way, as we said, this has spread to 830 schools. Millions of students are on it. What do you get out of it? Is there some financial investment in this for you?
Yeah, I mean, it is a company. It's set up. We moved out to California for a year, I guess. We started taking some time off from school, and now we're just hanging out and working on this because it's more interesting than school for the time being. Fortunately, Harvard will let us back whenever we want to go back. But we have 3.6 million users on the site. At any given time during the day, we generally have more than 100,000 people logged in. And, I mean, that takes a lot of machinery to support that type of infrastructure, and that obviously takes money to run. So we do a bunch of advertising on the site, and, I mean, we're doing it just so that we can kind of keep the site running and keep growing.
Right. I'm wondering, what does this say to you, Adam Weinberg at Colgate, about this generation of students?
On the positive side, I think it suggests that it's a generation of kids coming to college that care deeply about friendship and community. We're just seeing a huge uptick in young people who care about things beyond themselves, and that's really good. On the negative side, I think it suggests that it's also a generation that really wants to define that narrowly and wants to kind of meet and socialize with other people like themselves. And we really need to kind of make sure that we're producing a generation of young people who can thrive in diverse environments. But I think the other piece, and if I was Mark, this is one of the things that I would be claiming as a great success, is it's fundamentally changing campus culture in ways that are really positive, that are much more egalitarian. I think traditionally, the way you met people on a college campus was you joined a group. You joined a fraternity, a sorority, an athletic team, a theater group. And many of those organizations are very hierarchical and exclusive. Facebook really throws that out the window and allows everybody and anybody to kind of meet each other, to start groups. And that means that campus culture is becoming much more robust, much more egalitarian, much more democratic. Nobody owns it anymore. And that's really neat. That's really exciting. I think it says a lot about the millennial generation.
There is that. But then do you worry that within that generation, those who aren't going to colleges aren't a part of this group? Or would that be true anyway, with or without the Facebook?
I think anybody in higher ed would say that we have to deal with the access problem in higher education. Absolutely.
That's Adam Weinberg. He's a sociologist and dean of Colgate University. We also spoke with the director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School, John Palfrey. John, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Robin.
Adam, thank you.
You.
And Mark Zuckerberg, who was the creator, along with some friends, of the Facebook.com. Good luck to you, Mark, and thanks for speaking to us.
Thank you.
And this note, Monday on Here and Now, should they stay or should they go? Disagreements over whether U.S. troops should stay the course or pull troops out of Iraq are causing strange bedfellows. Divisions within the left and the right will have two perspectives. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now. Happened to the Valerie Plame affair, the story that sizzled earlier this summer? A special prosecutor is expected to wrap up in October his probe into the case of the CIA agent, Plame, who was outed after her husband, diplomat Joseph Wilson, criticized White House claims about pre-war intelligence on Iraq. Well, a story in the Los Angeles Times this week connects the dots in the Plame story and concludes that it reveals a lot about the Bush administration and exposes a series of White House misjudgments. Reporter Tom Hamburg co-wrote the article. He's on the line with us. And Tom, let's go back to the beginning. Joseph Wilson traveled to Niger, then later spoke out saying that Iraq did not seek uranium from the African nation as the Bush administration claimed. Now, you say the first mistake the administration made was underestimating Wilson's impact.
Robin, we've talked with some folks inside the White House who tell us that 4th of July weekend 2003, they had known about Joe Wilson, knew he was going to be making a splash that Sunday, and deliberately decided not to offer strong administration on the record reaction to Wilson.
They thought, just go away.
They thought, it's a holiday weekend, who's going to pay attention to this guy?
Well, and of course, his appearance on Meet the Press and his op-ed piece, you know, caused a sensation. And then you quote officials as saying that they now say that in hindsight, their second big mistake was the way in which the White House then aggressively attacked Wilson. How so?
Well, when Joe Wilson emerged, he came to embody all of the growing doubts about the war and the pre-war intelligence. And the White House realized at this point that they needed to counter him and counter him hard. One of the ways in which they decided to counter him was to suggest that, contrary to the implication that this was some high-level trip authorized by the vice president, he in fact was sent by his wife. One administration official calling Walter Pincus of the Washington Post even used the phrase, this is Pincus's reconstruction of it, a boondoggle set up by his wife. The idea was to discredit him by suggesting that he, Wilson, had inflated his mission and its import. And this, of course, in the course of mentioning his wife, a law may have been breached, and we're now seeing the unintended consequences of that action.
Well, in addition to that quagmire, what are the other reasons that that was the wrong tack to take? I mean, were there other tacks they could have taken?
In hindsight, what we hear from some of the White House staff is we had grounds to question Joe Wilson. One was that he had exaggerated his claims that his trip was far less conclusive than he made it sound. Second, Joe Wilson by this point was working for the Kerry campaign, and that was considered a more legitimate ground on which to criticize him. But that what became emphasized and what hit the press and what ultimately hit, caught the prosecutor's interest was the attack or the reference to his wife.
And let's be clear here. The documents on which the Bush administration were basing their claims were ultimately proven to be forgeries. And there was a lot going on in the Bush White House, as you write. There was a public face boasting of weapons of mass destruction, but there was a private face that was doubting it.
At this point in 2003, when Joe Wilson emerges, the White House is still publicly saying, we're confident we're going to find it. But the various investigations, the team in Iraq led by David Kay, were coming up with zero. And this was unnerving. To the White House, at all quarters in the White House and the administration, not the least of which was Karl Rove, who had his eye on the upcoming re-election battle a little over a year away.
Well, there was something else going on behind the scenes, and this is the third point you make, that the White House went into this food fight, as one administration official called it, with a predisposed hatred of the CIA. I mean, this was allowed to fester at the White House. Explain, briefly where that came from, especially in Dick Cheney's office, and what effect that had.
Yes, Robin, one of the questions that we approached this whole contretemps, is why is it that people as smart and as senior as Karl Rove and Dick Cheney's chief of staff, Scooter Libby, why would they go so far as to mention, in any context, the wife of a former envoy who made the trip? And one of the reasons that we're told that they may have taken steps that now seem extreme or a little over the top is that there was in the White House, in addition to the concern about the election we just mentioned, a lot of concern about who would bear responsibility, who would get the blame as in the aftermath of the invasion for the failure to find WMD. And there was a lot of both fear and anger and resentment in some quarters of the White House towards the CIA. Some of it historical. Some of it goes back to the time when Dick Cheney was at the Defense Department during the first Gulf War, and the CIA had failed to accurately predict Saddam's store of and sophistication in developing weapons of mass destruction then. And from that period and from other things, there was an extraordinary resentment in some quarters of the White House towards the CIA. Mm-hmm. And some people surmise or theorize that when Joe Wilson emerged from his CIA mission, publicly questioning the administration at such a sensitive time, that this was yet was part of the blame game and part of it was seen somehow as an attack from the CIA or from some quarters of the CIA, and it produced a kind of visceral response.
Right, and perhaps an overreaction and perhaps blinded them. This is reporter Tom Hamburger, who wrote a deconstruction of the Valerie Plame affair for the Los Angeles Times. And you said you had questions going into this report. Tom, do you still have questions coming out? And what do you overall think this story says about this Bush administration?
We found no evidence that anyone inside the White House was deliberately seeking to unmask a CIA agent. No one was knowingly, we don't have evidence that anyone was
right.
Seeking to knowingly break the law. But in the, maybe this is where you were going with blindly, but in the desire and the haste to criticize or discredit administration critic Joe Wilson, somebody appears to have gone too far and miscalculated in bringing in his. It's not necessarily a miscalculation to bring in a spouse, but if the spouse is a covert CIA agent, it's a serious miscalculation. And that seems to be the consensus of what happened in this case.
And the questions that you raised in the beginning of the report that, again, we might find out in October, why did Karl Rove and Vice President Cheney's top aide, Scooter Libby, and others counter Wilson so aggressively? How did their roles remain secret until after the president was reelected, and have they fully cooperated with the investigation? We won't know those answers till October.
The prosecutor is not required, Robin, to issue a report. He can file a report to the Justice Department, and if the report is made public, perhaps we'll know. But there's a possibility that we'll never know the answers to those questions.
Tom Hamburger, reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Tom, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
And as always, we welcome your thoughts on anything on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line, leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please tell us how to pronounce your full name and tell us the town you're from. Still to come, backstage at the Williamstown Theater Festival with hopeful apprentices and no Donald Trump. The buffalo may not be the only thing roaming with the deer and the antelope on the Great Plains if some prominent ecologists have their way. In an article in the current issue of Nature magazine, several ecologists describe a plan to transplant African animals, such as lions and elephants, to the Great Plains of the U.S. The piece is called Rewilding North America. Harry Green is one of the authors. He joins us on the line from Ithaca, New York. Welcome, Professor.
How are you, Robin?
I'm fine, but lions in Nebraska, you know, it sounds a little scary to people. Tell us a little more about the plan.
The most important thing to say is what we're really interested in doing is restoring animals that actually were here until about 100 to 120 centuries ago. So that's the most basic goal we're trying to accomplish.
Well, what kinds of animals and from where?
Well, for example, there were about five kinds of elephants and their relatives here. There were five or six kinds of wild horses. There was the lion that was all over the northern hemisphere and so forth. And these animals only remain today in Africa and in some cases in Asia. So we'll use some of those animals as proxies for these things that used to be here.
And is it because the animals aren't surviving there or because you'd like to restore the populations here?
It's much more because we'd like to restore those animals here and have them contribute to the ecosystems in the way they used to as predators and seed dispersers and herbivores and so forth.
Well, that word predators jumps out because many people would think that these animals would become predators. What will that mean for the current animal population?
Actually, I think it'd probably be very good in some cases, for example, in dealing with the overpopulation of wild horses in western North America. We think it'd have good effects just like the wolves have had in Yellowstone during the short period they've been back.
But some would say times have changed. I mean, you know, there are now suburbs in the Great Plains where the cousins of these lions might have roamed. So how will you deal with that?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's the most challenging issue is whether or not, first of all, we could ensure the security of people and their property and their livestock and so forth if these animals were anywhere near there. And, you know, the other side of that coin is sort of, as a culture, are we willing to sort of put up with animals that could hurt us, or are we going to push them off the earth, so to speak?
Well, Harry, what about the thinking that I'm going to have you dip your toe into the whole evolution debate, that this is how it's supposed to work, that if you believe in evolution, these animals have evolved out of this country. They don't belong here anymore.
Well, that's a great question. You know, one of the things we'd like to promote, though, is sort of keeping open the possibilities for future evolution in the face of things like climate change. So having populations of these animals here in North America actually sort of increases the possibility that at least somewhere on Earth, say several centuries from now, there will have been elephants that continued to adapt to these changing climate conditions.
So you're saying man has fooled around with evolution by changing things like the weather and the climate?
Absolutely, and by breaking up connections among these organisms so that there's not gene flow and there aren't as many populations anymore.
Well, and while some people might be worried that they'd be hurt by the animals, others are worried that the animals might be hurt by us. Are you worried that, for instance, will these animals be able to survive the climates of the area, the hunters in the area?
All this would be science-driven. So before we went, we're not going to just, you know, willy-nilly drive a truck out somewhere and let a bunch of lions go. We envision this being primarily planned by people who are experts on lions and where they can survive and so forth.
Right. And so where are you in the planning stages?
Very, very early. This is sort of a trial balloon. This idea has actually been around for a while, and it hasn't been taken too seriously or examined in any detail. So what we did was assemble a group of a dozen people with various expertises, and we sat in a ranch for 3 days, and we sort of argued this out and came up with some assumptions and some guidelines and so forth, and now we're going to the next stage.
Yeah, and people like me are calling you, and the word is getting out. What kind of feedback are you getting?
All over the map, all the way from people who want to jump in and help to people who are sort of cautiously critical and have read the paper carefully. And I guess the most discouraging thing is we've actually gotten hate mail.
Really? What are they saying?
I think the two things that really loom are that the mistaken one is that many people think this is equivalent to introducing alien species like the rabbits in Australia. And so on that, we can just try to give them a more realistic perspective. The other one is what you raised, which is there really is this issue of could these animals hurt us? Could you actually safely pull something like this off yet? And my attitude is we actually don't know, and so we want to explore this in a very careful way.
Yeah. Harry Green, professor of ecology at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Take care, Robin.
And Professor Green supports his idea in the current issue of Nature magazine in a piece called Rewilding North America. You can find it at our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now. Great actors are not usually born that way. They have to work at it. And many start off as apprentices, mopping stages or selling tickets at summer theater companies for little or no money. The prestigious Williamstown Theater Festival in the Berkshire Mountains of Western Massachusetts has an apprentice program that's known for putting aspiring actors through the real-world rigors of professional theater. Sigourney Weaver, the late Christopher Reeve, and Kate Hudson all started their careers at Williamstown. And as producer Andrea Shea found, this year's class of apprentices hopes to follow them into the footlights.
The Tony Award-winning Williamstown Theater Festival isn't summer stock. It's 10 weeks of large-scale, ambitious theater put on by some of New York City's best directors, actors, and designers. The 66 festival apprentices get to work closely with these seasoned professionals on shows like Lady Windermere's Fan by Oscar Wilde, Tom Stoppard's On the Razzle, and Carol Churchill's Top Girls.
Ah, Jim! Thank God! We can all dance!
The opening act of Top Girls takes place in a restaurant. The all-women cast enjoys a meal while discussing what they've given up to find success in their lives. Downstairs in a basement dressing room, a group of apprentices wait for their cue. In a few minutes, they'll be on the main stage in the festival's new $50 million theater in costume, moving furniture and props between scenes. 22-year-old Erica Lopez is one of them.
I just graduated from college, and I knew that it was time to just jump in at the bottom and start schlepping.
Lopez elaborates.
We have to get here an hour and a half before every show. We have to clean God knows how many dishes every single day. On days we have two shows, I swear we spend like half the day leaning over a sink washing dishes that have just been used in the big dinner scene. I spend every day before the show mopping the floor. I swear I'm covered in mop water right now. Like, it's stuff like that. I mean, it's not pretty work, but, you know, it's just really interesting. Like, a lot of the actresses that are now working on this, a lot of them started as apprentices either here or at other places. You know, they all know the type of work that we have to do, and you see that it does pay off.
That's the hope, at least. Accepted applicants pay $3,500 to be here for the summer. Most of that covers their room and board. But as artistic associate Amanda Charlton explains, some apprentices don't always get what they bargained for.
We're not a camp. We're not a college. You know, we're a theater festival, functioning professional theater festival. And I think sometimes people aren't ready to be here. And sometimes the people that are completely blossom. And it's kind of a harsh thing to witness, but it's kind of the reality.
The apprentices' day-to-day reality is dictated by their daily schedule.
The schedule is like your Bible. Like, the schedule is like your life.
That's 26-year-old Colleen Britt. She, like many of the older apprentices, lives the life of a struggling actor in New York City. Being here is hard, she says, but worth it. Each apprentice is expected to work three shifts a day, 7 days a week. Sarah McClellan has what's got to be one of the trickiest jobs at the festival. Every day she juggles calls from designers and stage managers looking for extra bodies and hands. McClellan then makes the assignments. She says a job can be anything from constructing a giant star out of chicken wire, to helping an equity actor rehearse their lines, to, and this is a quote, scraping and gooping.
What they were doing was they were taking these very pristine brick walls that had been painted and made, and they were destroying them with cheese graters and X-Acto knives.
McClellan posts the schedule on a big board every night around 8 o'clock. The apprentices swarm to see what tomorrow will bring.
Scenic Delft Tree, they're sending me away for the morning.
You got that too?
Yeah.
Afternoon and night?
Morning.
Scenic Delft Tree is the scene shop. It's located in a warehouse 5 miles from Williams College, where the festival is based. The apprentices pile out of a van and march inside to help build and paint sets. The smell in here is indescribable, a combination of sawdust, paint, and drying mushrooms from the packaging company on the ground floor. 20-year-old Jonathan Bach explains why, in addition to being nicknamed the Mushroom Factory, Delft Tree is sometimes called Siberia.
I think usually when you're assigned Delft Tree, you kind of sigh and roll your eyes. Most of the time, also, you're here for the entire day, meaning 10 to 6. They're about 8-hour shifts most of the time, and they're pretty intense.
As he works, Bach explains why he's pursuing a career in one of the toughest, most competitive fields imaginable. He admits it's scary, but adds,
you just kind of have to leap, and if you fall, then you fall, but, you know, this is what I want to be doing, and this is the only thing that really makes me happy or excites me, so there's no point in worrying about how hard it is. I mean, the difficulties will be there, but you just gotta plow through, you know?
Back on campus, a bunch of apprentices play football and socialize on the grass outside the dorms. 22-year-old Joe Coffey says before he was an actor, he played hockey.
My dad actually wanted me to be in the NHL by the time I was 18, and that didn't really work out. So there were some arguments, some tension between us for a while, but you know, everything's cool now.
Very cool, in fact, because Coffey has landed a minor character role in Tom Stoppard's whimsical play On the Razzle.
It's a small role, but it is a role, and every role is important. So every time I'd have to get on stage and try to get in character, whether it's with movement and walking or making sure my Scottish accent is right on for my one line.
So what's your one line?
Flora. That's all I say.
A role in a main stage production, even a tiny one, is a major coup for an apprentice. If they don't get cast, they still have chances to act in smaller plays with other apprentices. Roger Rees, the festival's new artistic director, understands that an actor will do anything to act.
We are somewhat abused because we love the thing we do.
Rees has dozens of stage, film, and television credits, including his role as Robin Colcord on Cheers. Sitting in the lobby of the festival's theater, he remembers his days as an apprentice at the Royal Shakespeare Company in England, where he and Ben Kingsley swept the stage and changed scenery when they were just starting out. 20 years later, Rees and Kingsley played Hamlet on that very stage. The veteran actor has obvious sympathy for the apprentices at Williamstown, but says there's no better way to learn, even if some of the lessons are harsh.
I've been, you know, dragged off stage by a leading actor and yelled at because I did something wrong while he was on stage. That's a lesson I'll remember all my life, and I won't do it again. It's that sort of thing. It's just the apprenticeship served is what you do as an actor.
Acting is a craft that's handed down, says Rees. He also says the apprentices are the crucible for the next generation of Shakespearean actors because
we'll all be dead, you know, or we'll be playing the gravedigger. We'll all be auditioning for the Gravedigger. But they'll be the ones playing Hamlet, you know, or Richard II or Juliet. And I see them here just growing in confidence over these 10 weeks, just getting a little better, learning a little bit more. Their voice is getting stronger. You know, it's great. It's a wonderful thing to see.
I see a lot of tired faces here at the festival, but the aspiring actors seem to relish the work, whether they're learning lines or breaking down sets. Maybe it's their youth, but I suspect that discovering what it really takes to live a life in theater 24/7 is what sustains them for their 10 intense weeks at Williamstown.
What is this thing called?
Yeah.
What?
Ratchet.
Like a nurse ratchet.
Yep.
This is the most handiwork I've ever done in my whole life.
All right.
Hey, Lauren. Where are you?
There's no business like show business, like no business I know. Everything about it is appealing.
Our visit to the Williamstown Theater Festival was produced by Andrea Shea. The festival closes this Sunday with a performance of Bus Stop. Both the star, Logan Marshall Green, and director Will Frears were apprentices at Williamstown in 2001. For more information and to see a picture of this year's apprentices so you can say you knew them when, go to our website, here-now.org. And by the way, another future star heading for Williamstown, Mass. To return to Williams College, our intern, Noah Suskind. Noah, will say we knew you when as well. Here and Now, a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again. Here and
Funding
Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com. And by REMAX of New England, a source for real estate assistance in New England, featuring an online renovation guide, agent locator, and comprehensive property search. REMAX-NewEngland.com.
When your heart beats like a... I'm Robin Young. Join us next